next case on the diamond is Chico versus Rama Sandoval Candelaria, case number 2011-715. Both parties ready?
Yes, sir.
Argument is set for an hour, half an hour aside. People have to keep track of your time when you speak. Please tell us who you are and who you represent. And for those of you here in the audience who didn't hear me this morning, some of us use iPads. We're not surfing text. We're looking at briefs and looking at our notes and sometimes checking links to Westlaw. So, with that, we're ready. Ms. Hanson?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Katherine Hanson, registration number 25464, appearing on behalf of the people in this matter. In this case, we have one delay, no objection, and two legal claims being raised. The Court of Appeals correctly determined that there was no objection. However, the Court of Appeals incorrectly determined that the delay in this case violated the defendant's rights under 32B and under the speedy trial provisions. Basically, what happened in this case is that the defendant was charged in a 2004 case, and I'll refer to that as the Anguan case. The defendant was charged with that. He pled not guilty in September of 2004. After that, we have approximately 13 continuances requested in that case, either by the prosecution, the defense, or joint request for continuances. In the meantime, in November of 2004, the defendant committed the homicide at issue here. In March of 2005, for reasons that are unknown, the defendant withdrew his not guilty plea in the en banc case, which essentially put that case in a pre-arraignment position where a speedy trial was not running. In July, and in that case, just continued to trial while this case, the 2005 case, was being prepared. The parties went to trial in July of 2006, and there was a conviction in the 2005 case on July 25th of 2006. At that point, the en banc case was still trailing. It still had not even been to arraignment yet, just continuance after continuance. And we know from some of the comments the court made later, they had been trailing that case behind this one. In August 28th, 2006, the date scheduled for sentencing in this case and the next appearance in the 2004 case, the parties proceeded to sentencing, but when the prosecutor indicated he made a reference to the defendant being on bond, the court, apparently not realizing the defendant had been on bond when he committed this offense, suggested that they delay the sentencing in this case to allow that other case to be resolved one way or the other. The defendant objected to that only on grounds that his defense counsel would not be available after November until March, that she would be on maternity leave. The defense counsel did make a comment saying, after objecting based on the unavailability issue, did make a comment saying, and a delay doesn't serve any other purpose other than allowing the court to impose an aggravated range sentence. The defense attorney went on to reiterate that she would not be available until March. After that point, the court did go ahead and delay the sentencing in this case. There was approximately four more continuances in the en banc case until January of 07. The defendant did plead guilty in that case, asked for a continuance until March for sentencing in both cases so that his defense counsel could be present. So that's the procedural history of the case. If you look at the total delay from the date of conviction in the 2005 case, which is the conviction being appealed here, the sentence being appealed, I apologize, to the date of ultimate sentence, it was 7 months and 9 days. How I think it's important, however, and I think the defendant seems to acknowledge, we look generally at the delay here being from the date of the first sentencing, which is when he said sentencing should have occurred, to the ultimate date of sentencing, which was approximately 6 months. I think first it's important to put this case in the proper posture and understand the proper standard of review. because that is definitely in dispute here. The Court of Appeals found that, based on the facts I just discussed, that there was no objection to the delay based on the 32B and the speedy trial claims that he has raised on appeal. The court basically found, as I argued, that the objection is only based on defense counsel's unavailability. And I think that's a proper interpretation of the facts. The defendant, again, did say, make a comment regarding, I don't think the delay serves any other purpose than allowing a 12-year sentence, but that's not the same as saying, I don't think there's no purpose for this delay, which is how the defense characterizes that comment. It's simply an observation that the only purpose for delay is to serve 12 years, or is to allow the court to impose up to 12 years, and that was exactly the reason for delay. So it was an awkward observation, not an objection.
Could I ask you a question right there? I didn't go back and check all the statutory provisions. You said to allow the court to impose a sentence up to 12 years. This particular provision, all of those, some 9 months, am I wrong in saying they don't extend the range to which somebody could be sentenced? They simply cut off the lower end.
Well, what it does is, I believe it's a midpoint to twice the max. So,
it's a mandatory minimum, right?
Correct. And so it requires a sentence in DOC, certainly, but it also allows for going up to the 12 years, which would be ordinarily the top on the discretionary aggravated range. However, with these factors being found, it would require any sort of likely compliant facts being found by a jury.
I guess part of where I'm going with that is, several times in the briefs and sometimes in our other cases, we've said something about extending the sentence. But that clearly is not in terms of the number of years that the judge could have given based on discretionary considerations,
correct,
right? Didn't increase the range. So when we say that, or when you say that, are you suggesting then that this provides, you know, since you can still, under the statute, sentence down to the midpoint of the presumptive range, even finding this factor clearly does not require a sentence in the aggravated range, is that right?
Correct. It does not require, it doesn't extend the sentence, and in fact, the Court of Appeals remand order mandating a sentence in the presumptive range needs to be corrected as well, because there's no reason that the court can't consider discretionary aggravation. It just must do so in compliance with the requirements that this court and the Supreme Court has set out.
I don't mean to take you too far away from the timing, and I'll let you get back to that, but since we got off on this point, so notwithstanding what the trial judge did and thought and said, do you understand the statute to in any way have permitted the judge to do something he couldn't have done had he just on his own found that committing a murder during this time period amounted to an aggravating circumstance?
Well, if the court had found discretionary aggravation in compliance with Blakely and Apprendi, then absolutely the court could have imposed a sentence in the aggravated range. I think that they didn't really talk about whether there were Blakely compliant factors. I think the issue was just this would open up that range without those extra procedures, and because it also made the mandatory minimum higher than what is available in the presumptive range. And so basically what the court specifically said is, I want to do this so that I can be working under what I feel is the appropriate sentencing range for someone who has committed a crime on bond, who is subsequently convicted.
And the sort of minor premise there that we're assuming then is, which maybe is true, is that for him to have been able to do this without the statutory finding, without the another jury having made the conviction, would require factual determination on his part, and therefore would have been been subject to Blakely or Apprendi?
Well, I don't know that the court, I mean, I think the court talked about feeling, when it was going through the initial part of the original sentencing hearing, that it was uncomfortable being limited to 6 years, which would have been the max in the presumptive range. And so, while no one really got into at that point whether there were any Blakely compliant factors that the court could use to impose discretionary aggravation, I guess presumably the court, there certainly were no procedures that had already been done to allow the court to do that. And so I think the court was likely under the impression that it would not be able to impose, at least at the point at which it chose to make this delay, because there had been no argument yet on whether there were such factors. But I think the court felt 6 years may not be enough, and we have this en banc situation, and we have a factor that's required in order to apply that statute that hasn't been resolved one way or the other yet. It's not like it had already been resolved against me, it just hadn't been resolved yet. And under the circumstances of this case, the court clearly determined, both by its comments at the original sentencing and then again in the subsequent sentencing, that 6 years wasn't enough. And the court also indicated that it wanted to consider this appropriate, the sentencing range if it was appropriate, which is consistent with the intent of the statute, which is to punish recidivists more severely. And so basically the delay was to determine whether he was in fact a recidivist. So the question...
But neither party asked for this continuance. The court kind of intervenes in this. Clearly could have gone ahead and imposed whatever sentence the court thought was indicated. So in this construing the rule, reasonable delay, what kind of time frame are we supposed to, what rule are we supposed to do? Gallagher clearly holds it a year is too long, right? And the consideration of leniency wasn't an appropriate reason for the delay. Correct? Well, amazing.
Gallagher actually doesn't set a timeline. Gallagher had a problem with the what was a one-year delay, but not because it was 1 year, but because it allowed the parties to circumvent the two prior felony rule, which required a sentence to prison. So it was the manner in which the delay was used to seek the purpose of avoiding the rule.
Okay.
That's what the court had a problem with. I don't think there was any specific concern with the year. And basically, all we really have with regard to interpreting Gallagher is, interpreting the rule is Gallagher, and all Gallagher really holds is that you can't delay to circumvent a statute that clearly applies whether you do it now or then, and circumvent the intent of the legislature in imposing that prior felony rule. So here, we don't have anything that the court circumvented. We have a delay, the rule allows for delay, it just can't be unreasonable. And so what this court should do, as it does with many situations when you're having to determine whether something is reasonable or not, is look at all the totality of the circumstances. And there's no question the defendant was on notice that he was subject to the sentence enhancement provision. He was charged with it. The delay in the other case was pretty extreme, but it seemed as though the parties wanted to allow that case to trail the murder case. We don't have anything in the record because the defendant didn't make any objection on either ground as to whether they did that for purposes of perhaps dismissing the en banc case if he was convicted of first degree murder, which would require a life sentence, avoiding perhaps a trial in the en banc case. That may have been their purpose in trailing. I know that the court said twice at the sentencing proceedings that it's common to allow sentencing to trail these other cases that are still pending. And certainly if you look at a lot of the federal cases, they acknowledge the propriety of doing that. And so we really have little guidance. I think it's important what Gallagher does tell us is to look at the purpose for which the delay is being sought and determine whether the delay whether that's a legitimate purpose and the manner in which it's done is being legitimate. I recognize in Gallagher the higher purpose was for rehabilitation, but the delay itself was to avoid the two-part felony rule. Whereas here, the purpose is to determine whether this sentencing range that the legislature has determined should apply to recidivists should apply, because if that hasn't been determined yet. And I think the federal courts recognize that that's a legitimate reason for the delay. So in this case, we have a legitimate reason, unlike in Gallagher, and we have a pretty short delay. We certainly don't have a lengthy delay. In fact, if you look at the length of time between the first sentencing and the guilty plea, which is when the defendant requested additional time, that was a 4-month delay. so we even have a shorter period. So I think if you look at the totality of the circumstances, as long as there's a legitimate purpose, the manner in which it's done doesn't circumvent any statutory requirements, and the length of the delay is unreasonable to serve these purposes, I think this court can find that the delay was reasonable in this case and didn't violate 32B.
Counsel, if we agree with you and were to come up with a rule that said that it wasn't unreasonable for the trial court to delay to determine whether this particular sentencing statute would apply, are we setting up a situation where we are basically telling trial courts, in fact, that you should wait in order to find out whether that sentencing factor would apply? In other words, in some future case, is a trial court going to read this rule and then be thinking that they are, in fact, required to delay to make that determination?
Well, I think what this case, if this court agreed, would stand for the proposition that this is a legitimate purpose for seeking a delay. However, the statute rule doesn't say you can have delay as long as there's a legitimate purpose. The rule says you can have delay as long as it's reasonable. And so the purpose is one factor to consider in determining whether it's reasonable. But other factors such as, for example, if the defendant had clearly, for example, let's say we have affirmative evidence on the record that he had specifically delayed the other case in order to hopefully not have it apply if he was sentenced in this case, I think it would be reasonable. That would be another factor you could consider, the length of the delay. So I think that this court can certainly say, and should certainly say, that delaying for this purpose is a legitimate purpose. And so therefore, it's not unreasonable delay.
And it's a legitimate purpose because this statute would apply if, in fact, the en banc case had resolved in a conviction.
Yes.
Okay. And I guess what I'm a little bit concerned about is if we're suggesting then that it would apply once the en banc case has been resolved, are we then suggesting to the courts that in a future case, in fact, you should delay. You should make it sure to find out when the en banc case is in fact resolved in order to determine whether this aggravating provision sentencing range does apply. And I guess I'm a little bit concerned about that because maybe we find ourselves in sort of a future Gallagher situation where the trial court is presented with an opportunity to go ahead and sentence today before the en banc case has resolved in order to avoid applying the aggravated sentencing range.
So what you're suggesting is then that people would appeal saying that's an unreasonable
delay? Right, in other words,
if delay?
People were to say, no, I want sentencing to, the prosecution could then request a delay in order for that en banc case to be resolved because the people would be in a position to argue for a larger or higher sentencing range.
And I think that would be a legitimate argument for the people to make.
Okay.
Because I think that the intent of the statute is to allow courts to punish recidivists more severely.
So in that case, would the trial court be abusing its discretion sort of under the Gallagher theory if it didn't?
Okay. I mean, if that's the only reason and everything else had been done in the ordinary course of business, arguably yes. Because the legislature has said we want these people punished more severely. And if the only reason why the en banc case hasn't been resolved is for scheduling reasons, and certainly if the en banc case hasn't been resolved because of the defendant's conduct, such as requesting continuances or withdrawing pleas, things like that, or had consented to the trailing like we did in this case, then I think it would be arguably a problem. I mean, it would be something that the court is arbitrarily deciding not to delay for no apparent reason. And so, of course, every case has to be looked at under the facts and circumstances of each case. But if that was the only reason why the trial court said, no, we're not going to delay this because I don't want to be required to apply the sentencing provision, I think that would be an abuse of discretion.
Okay, well, let's assume that the people didn't make that request for delay. Is the trial court on its own required to go ahead and delay? I mean, here we have a sui sponsa delay, but I'm thinking about the reverse situation in a future case.
Well, I think it's hard to argue that the trial court abuses discretion when no one requested it.
Okay.
So it would be an issue of whether, does this court create a sui sponsa rule that in every case, if there's this case pending out there and it has been resolved, the court has to delay. You know, we're not asking the court to make that ruling, and I don't think this court should make that ruling based on the facts of this case. And we have a we have the issue raised by the court, but the court asked the parties, you know, how they felt about that, and the prosecutor said yes, that would be appropriate. And so, and in this case, of course, we have a delay. So we have the defendant complaining that the delay was unreasonable. So, but I don't see a problem with the notion that in situations like this, with everything else being neutral, if that en banc case has not been resolved yet, that a brief delay or a reasonable delay in order to determine whether that occurs or not is appropriate, is a legitimate purpose for a delay.
And not to borrow all of your time, but
it's okay.
At what point does that delay then become unreasonable? Do we just look to that 1 year bright line?
Well, unfortunately, it's hard because then you start getting into the speedy sentencing factors, and there with speedy trial, we've used some bright line rules or presumptive prejudice, such as the 1 year for speedy trial, the 2 year for speedy appeal, things like that. But even then, it's just presumptive prejudice. I think here, it's just unreasonable. It's the question, is it unreasonable? And you really have to look to the totality of the circumstances. You have to weigh the factors, you have to weigh the facts. Again, if the defendant has caused the delay, or if once they've reset this, then like in this case, the defendant asked for 4 continuances of the en banc case. They could have perhaps resolved that within a month. We don't know, because we don't have an objection or any sort of findings below. But those are factors, I think, that all just go into the mix, and that's why I think a ruling of unreasonable delay should be considered an abuse of discretion standard, if it's objected to, as opposed to plain error, which is what we have here.
Thank you. Counsel, before you move on, I think the Court of Appeals looked at this very differently and basically said the statutory language says was convicted, and the defendant here was not convicted yet, and therefore it was inappropriate. And I'm wondering if you can tell me why that's incorrect, in your view.
Absolutely. The Court of Appeals said this is inappropriate because it interpreted the intent of the statute as to require a sentence enhancement only if the person's been convicted. Well, that's certainly a proper interpretation of the language and the requirements of the statute. That doesn't address the intent of the statute.
Isn't that intent reflected in the language that says was convicted? That's part of, can you help me with that?
Correct. And if he was sentenced on that day, absolutely that statute would not apply. And so sentencing him in the aggravated range, had they done that on that day, would have been contrary to both the language and the intent of the statute. But because at that point we don't know if he's a recidivist. But the Court of Appeals basically said that the intent of the statute is to punish people who have already been convicted at that point. I think that's incorrect. The intent of the statute is to create enhanced sentencing for recidivists. How we do that, you look to the plain language of the statute, and the prior conviction requirement in the statute, which is what is at issue here, there's a separate purpose for that, and I think that's to ensure that the person is in fact a recidivist. So you have the statutory language, which basically says, this is what you can do, and the person has to have been convicted. And there's no question, had they been sentenced that day, it would not have applied. But the purpose of the statute is to give lengthier sentences to recidivists. And so, because the court couldn't do that on that date, but determined that whether he was a recidivist was still an issue, the court felt that it was proper to delay in order to make that determination. And so I think that's where the Court of Appeals really incorrectly interpreted the statute in finding that the intent was somehow the requirement. The intent is, to me, the purpose for why you're allowing the enhanced sentencing. And again, there is that separate prior conviction requirement, which the intent of that is to make sure that we're dealing with the recidivist and not someone who's ultimately been acquitted.
Ms. Hanson, I think it seems to me that what you said before is very accurate, that we're talking about unreasonable, depending on the circumstances. at least in my experience, it's very common knowledge to take a lesser charge and put it after the more serious charge for obvious reasons. And that's certainly a significant factor in this case.
Absolutely, and it would have been...
Because the time is actually, if you figure out a good time for Gallagher,
mm-hmm.
it's probably no different than the time here. I mean, where it's...
Right.
We're splitting hairs, not the delay itself.
Well, it certainly is likely that had the defendant objected on these grounds and had the court been called upon to make an initial determination of the reasonableness of the delay, the parties could have discussed whether that was their, in fact, their purpose, was to trail the en banc case because it was less serious.
Well, I think it's a very common practice.
Absolutely, and I think the court's comments on two occasions, I think at the sentencing hearing where the court said that's referred to the en banc condition requirement, and said that's why we trail these cases, but also made reference to you generally trail these cases that are less serious. So I think that even though we don't have certainly a finding that that was part of the reason for the delay, and why the delay in the en banc case occurred, I think it's a reasonable inference from the court's comments as well. I'm going to go ahead, if I can, and save my last 5 minutes.
You may.
Thank you very much.
Let's check.
It up a bit. I don't know if it's just me, but I can't.
You can raise it on the right hand side. You see a little toggle switch. There you go.
All right. May it please the court. My name is Ned Jacob. I represent the respondent, Mr. Sandoval Candelaria. There's three things I want to cover here. Two for sure, three to time to many. First, I want to sort of quickly summarize the procedural history here, because I think some of the state's use of words objection and so on things sort of leads to sort of a misleading impression. Secondly, I want to talk about Gallagher, and I want to put forth the argument that there is no principled reason from distinguishing this situation from the situation in Gallagher. And then third time permitting, I'd like to also discuss Mr. Sandoval's Sixth Amendment right to speedy trial, speedy sentencing in this context. First, just to review the procedural history. First, the court set this case for sentencing on August 28, 2006. As Judge Hoffman said in a later context, that was approximately within the usual time after a conviction that sentencing would occur. I think he turned that time, although he was talking in the en banc case, he turned that time, you know, ordinarily happened in 6 weeks. This is, what, 4.5 weeks. So it's within at the usual time for sentencing. As of that date, the pre-sentence report had been completed, it had been distributed to both parties.
I'm sorry. I'll give you an extra couple minutes here.
That's an interesting ring.
Yeah.
Unique.
I recognize it. I'm old enough to recognize it.
Harlan Grove Ultron is special.
Yeah. As I said, the pre-sentence report was ready. The date was the usual time for sentencing. Neither party asked to continue that date. I disagree with the state as to the court's awareness or the prosecution's awareness. The court was aware, right at that moment, that Mr. Sandoval Candelaria had been on bond in another case. And it pointed that out to the prosecution and asked the prosecutor if he wanted to proceed. And the prosecutor said that he did, in fact, want to proceed, notwithstanding that, as did the defense. And the court then did, in fact, proceed to sentencing. The court heard the arguments of both parties. The court heard from the victim's mother. The court itself observed that it had heard everything it is going to hear with respect to sentencing. And it was only at that point, one other fact bears mentioning, And that is that the court and the parties, and as the state says in its brief, and as I said in my brief, everyone agreed that the maximum available sentence on that date was 6 years. So I guess I would disagree with Justice Coates' observation that the delay did not extend the range. Everybody seemed to be in agreement that there were no discretionarily aggravating facts, that the court would be limited to just that six-year sentence if sentencing occurred as scheduled on that date.
But it didn't extend the statutory range, is that right?
Well, there was an acknowledgement, I believe, that there were no likely compliant facts that would allow sentencing out of the presumptive range. So on the mere possibility, mind you, that something in the future might occur that would extend the range, that's the rationale for delaying sentencing. I submit that there is no principled way of distinguishing this case from Gallagher. This case is Gallagher in every way that matters. First, both of the delays, the delay in Gallagher and the delay here, were done to achieve particular sentencing goals. In Gallagher, the delay in sentencing was to impose a more lenient sentence, or not to have to remand the defendant to the custody of the Department of Corrections. Here, it was extended on a contingency. If things broke a certain way, a higher sentencing range might be available. As the court observed when it ultimately did sentence Mr. Sandoval, it seemed to be wrong that I've been limited to 6 years. Secondly, in Gallagher and in this case, if sentencing proceeded on the date scheduled, both judges were thwarted from achieving the sentencing goal or aim that they wanted to achieve, and they were both thwarted from achieving that by the existence of a statute. In Gallagher, the statute was a two-prior felony rule, which, if sentencing proceeded on that day, would require that the defendant be remanded to the custody of the Department of Corrections. Here, a different statute, as well as the rule, intervenes, and that would be subsection 6 of the General Sentencing Statute, 18.1.3401, which says that a sentence shall be in the presumptive range absent the existence of an aggravating or mitigating factor. The court, the parties, everyone acknowledged that that was the range available to the court on that day. That was the sentence that would have to be imposed. But again, in Gallagher, as here, with the delay and only the delay would allow the court to achieve its sentencing goal. This court in Gallagher recognized that there was a reason, and perhaps a good reason, for the delay, and to be able to evade that particular statute, that would better serve the defendant's rehabilitative needs. Notwithstanding that salutary goal, that goal that's embodied in our sentencing code, this court in Gallagher said that is not permissible, that is not a justifiable reason, and it is not a justifiable reason because Rule 32B requires that sentencing take place without unreasonable delay. It found that the delay in Gallagher, notwithstanding that it served a sentencing goal, was unreasonable, that it was unjustified. I believe the same result must obtain here. There is no principled way to distinguish the two cases. The only difference is that the judge in Gallagher saw a more lenient sentence, the judge here saw a bigger range, a harsher sentence, with a higher minimum, a higher maximum sentence.
And so you sort of disagree with the opposing counsel's characterization of the one as seeking to circumvent a legislative goal or intent or purpose, and the other to actually accomplish it or further it.
I disagree. Both are circumventing a requirement of the statute. In this case, what's circumvented is the statute that says that absent aggravating circumstances, sentence must be in the presumptive range. In Gallagher, the statute circumvented his two prior felony rule, which would require him to be entrusted with the DOC.
And could I ask, so with regard to the question about construction, and what does it mean was convicted, at what point in time is your argument, and do you think the Court of Appeals argument was dependent on a construction of the actual words of that aggravator, meaning that you had to be convicted at the time of sentencing or at the time of commission in this case?
You know, it's an interesting question, Justice Coates, because I think another reading, no one made this reading, mind you, below, but another reading of the statute is that the conviction even has to take place before the present case. You know, it doesn't say that subsequently convicted, it just said was convicted. But definitely for that aggravator to apply, the conviction has to have occurred if that aggravator is to be employed and applied to the case.
And so with regard to your argument about timing here and everything, it really doesn't matter how long it was. Is that right from your argument? It's just the question of if you delayed it all because he wasn't already convicted at the time either of commission of offense or the time of trial, whichever would work best for you. But in any event, it couldn't possibly be that this statutory aggravator would apply to a conviction that actually occurred after the current sentencing.
Well, when the date is set for sentencing, in the normal course of events, the person has not suffered a conviction. When the prosecution of that case, I mean, Ms. Hansen lays a lot on the defendant here, but let's be honest and truthful here. The prosecution is acquiescing and participating and not diligently prosecuting that case as well. So the fact that that case hasn't been adjudicated, whatever might happen, can be laid at the feet of the prosecution and the court, which controls its own docket. You know, much more so than it can be on the defendant. The defendant can go about and waive speedy trial in that case so he's blue in the face, but the prosecutor in the court will go ahead and prosecute him for this particular ruling case. You know, it's going to happen, and it's going to happen. And I would submit that if the prosecutor seeks to aggravate on that basis, then it ought to diligently seek prosecution of that case. Of course, the funny part here, of course, is the prosecution didn't appear to seek aggravation based on that case. In fact, it was perfectly content to go ahead with sentencing on the regularly scheduled date. Only the court's intervention delayed the sentencing. I think Justice Marquez brings up an interesting point as to possible consequences of adopting the state's position here. Let's just take a look at a couple of different scenarios for the Tranley case. It took 13 months from the time that Mr. Sandoval was arraigned on this case until he was brought to trial. I mean, how long are we going to allow delay, given this rule, in order to determine at some future date that the defendant suffers a conviction and the aggravator applies? Are we going to wait 13 months if it takes as long as the prosecution in this case takes? It could be much longer. Consider a case where perhaps there was a preliminary hearing, where the case got dismissed on preliminary hearing and the prosecution has appealed that ruling. What happens then? Do we wait years for it to wind its way through the appellate process before sentence can be imposed, because we don't know if this person is going to be ultimately convicted of the en banc case? That would be the consequences of adopting the state's position.
Well, why don't you suggest to us language that we would write if we agree with you that would define the parameters of what an unreasonable delay is? We have a totality of the circumstances suggestion here. Do you have an alternative suggestion?
As to what's reasonable?
Right.
I would suggest that when the court and the prosecution haven't pursued something that they intend to use in the aggravator with diligence, then delaying to determine whether the aggravator applies is an unreasonable delay. when the delay is prejudicial to the defendant. And, of course, the other part of that, though, Justice Hobbs, is that the defendant, of course, has to be available and ask for sentencing, as he was in this case. He showed up on August 28th. He asked to pursue the sentencing, and he objected when the court delayed.
So what is this, an abuse of discretion? I mean, how do we draw the bright line on the unreasonable delay?
Well, I think if the court violates the rule of this court, which I think it clearly did under the Gallagher opinion in this case, I think it necessarily has abused its discretion. But as I've argued, and as two of the judges on the Court of Appeals found, this also is more than just an abuse of discretion, because it also violated Mr. Sandoval Candelaria's constitutional right under the Sixth Amendment to speedy sentencing, if you will.
I didn't think that was established, is it? What establishes that right?
The right to speedy sentencing?
Yeah.
It's true that the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has not said so, but this court has said as much, and in Moody versus Corsentino, which I cited in the brief, and I don't think the state even disputes this point, that the right is pretty well established and recognized universally by all federal district courts. But that is a constitutional right. So let me just summarize again. This is Gallagher in every way that matters. There's a statute that's circumvented here by the delay. There's a statute that's circumvented by the delay in Gallagher. The judge may have had a reason to delay, and Gallagher didn't have a reason here to delay. That's not good enough, according to this court in Gallagher. If there are no further questions on that, I'd like to turn now very briefly to the constitutional right to speedy sentencing. First, the six-month delay was presumptively prejudicial. I mean, it was actually prejudicial because it enabled the judge to impose a 12-year rather than a six-year sentence, as he acknowledged he would have to impose a sentencing proceeding on that day. But to the extent that presumptive prejudice is in play here, I submit that when the court sets sentencing at the regular time, in the ordinary and usual course of events, as Judge Hoffman said, this was within 6 weeks is the usual time. When the PSI is ready, when it's made available to everybody, when the parties in fact proceed to sentencing, and the court here is all going to hear with respect to sentencing, when no party asks for a continuance, and when no party objects to proceeding to sentencing, that delay in sentencing beyond that is not ordinary, and therefore the delay is necessarily, by definition, presumptively prejudicial. Next, the responsibility for the delay. Whose fault is the delay? The fault of the delay lies entirely at the feet of the court, at the feet of the prosecution. Well, in this instance, at the court, because only the court ordered the delay, the prosecution was perfectly content to go ahead with sentencing. So the delay cannot be attributed to the defendant, and to the extent that the court or the prosecutor or the court wanted the en banc case to be resolved by the time he imposed sentence, but as I said, that is entirely within the court's control. It is not within the defendant's control. The defendant's waiver of speedy trial does nothing if people want to go ahead with that prosecution. Next, the assertion of the right. The defendant was there. He asked to be sentenced, and he objected to the delay. I mean, I don't know how much more clearly you can assert your right to proceed to sentencing than that. And last, the prejudice. And the prejudice, of course, is the fact that it made a larger sentencing range available. Judge Hoffman acknowledged when he sentenced him that had he proceeded, he had only a six-year term available. The defendant, in fact, received a 12-year sentence.
Do you think prejudice in the constitutional sense refers simply to the fact that he could and did get a longer sentence, or is it limited to something occurring as a result of this delay that deprived him of an opportunity to prove the matters at issue in sentencing?
Well, there are
no witnesses died.
Right. No, I understand. Yeah, I think I understand your question. I mean, there are, there, this is the most obvious form of prejudice in this case, but I think prejudice in the constitutional sense is broader than that. I mean, there are certain types of prejudice, of course, as you pointed out, that occur with delays in speedy trial, I mean, first of trial, loss of defenses. With respect to sentencing, there are less tangible types of prejudice. You know, I guess he spends 6 months in the county jail, thereby delaying his rehabilitation in the Department of Corrections, that sort of thing. So there's that, you know, that type of prejudice is also a result of the court's delay. If there are no further questions, I'd ask that the court affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals.
Thank you, Mr. Jacob. Rebuttal, Ms. Hanson?
I'd just like to make a couple brief points. Sorry, I'm short. Going backwards, talking about the speedy trial or the speedy sentencing issue, I mean, clearly we've argued there's been no objection, and the defendant's only suggestion that there was an objection to any of this delay whatsoever is that there was no other purpose, and therefore that was a similar argument to arguing it's not a reasonable delay. I've already argued why that comment didn't preserve the 32B claim, but I think there should be no question that it didn't preserve a speedy trial claim or a speedy sentencing claim. And this court has repeatedly, the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, has repeatedly refused to acknowledge and address speedy sentencing, speedy trial claims that were not explicitly made below, primarily because you need to resolve issues regarding fact finding, fact disputes, and conclusions of law with a speedy sentencing claim. And because no objection was made on those grounds here, there were literally no findings on a speedy trial, speedy sentencing claim. In fact, the Court of Appeals decision was wrong in that respect too, because the court made reference to giving deference to the trial court's determination and factual findings. There were no factual findings on a speedy trial claim, speedy sentencing claim, because no such objection was made. And so I find it interesting that we would, first, I don't think based on that you should consider the claim at all. I think the case law is very clear. You don't consider this claim unless it was raised below. But certainly the defendant has the burden to establish the violation. And in order to establish presumptive prejudice, which is what's necessary to go on to anything other than the other Barker factors, including actual prejudice, is to establish presumptive prejudice. And the defendant suggests that we do that by showing what's the usual customary practice. And under the language in Doggett, that is a proper consideration for determining whether something's presumptively prejudicial. The problem is, we don't have anything in the record determining anything by the parties discussing what is usual and customary. The defendant makes reference to one comment when they were talking about whether to delay it for defense counsel's availability. And they talked about, well, usually it's about 6 weeks out or 4 weeks out. But they didn't talk about whether delay and involving trailing cases is a usual and customary practice. In fact, the court made several comments indicating that it was. So I think this highlights the exact reason why this claim should not be considered, is in order to get to presumptive prejudice, you have to determine whether it was beyond that which is usual and customary, and the defendant didn't provide any evidence below. We have no factual findings on what is customary when you have cases like this.
Ms. Sanson, could you, Mr. Jacob, in his briefs and also his argument, raises argument a pretty interesting position that, you know, basically we're being, this case, your position is inconsistent with Gallagher. And so, and that there's no way to distinguish Gallagher from this case and have a result that he's asking. I wonder if we could just spend about a minute, 23 seconds on your take on why you might disagree with him.
Well, absolutely. And basically, Gallagher doesn't purport to create any sort of boundaries of the rule. Gallagher simply says you cannot delay a sentencing if doing so circumvents a statutory requirement, a legal provision. That does not constitute a legitimate purpose for the delay, and therefore it's if you're doing it and you're violating the statute, it's unreasonable. So what we have, that's all that Gallagher holds. We don't have any similar facts. We have different statutes at issue. We have different sexes at issue. The only thing that's the same is basically the question of what's reasonable. Gallagher says even if the overarching purpose is legitimate, if the manner in which you do it violates the statute or provision, then it's unreasonable.
Well, I think his argument is, you know, the statute that on August 28th didn't require the aggravated sentence. Well, so therefore, you're violating the mandate of the statute. That's as I see it, his argument.
Had they sentenced him on that day, absolutely they would have been violating the statute.
Okay,
but that's not the question. The question here is whether it was okay to delay the sentencing. And delaying the sentencing in this case...
Why if they had sentenced him on that day, why would it be in violation of the statute?
The statutory language appears to require a conviction for the unlawful case.
Oh, I see.
Had the court applied that statute on that day...
I understand completely.
Okay.
I misunderstood this.
But we don't have any circumvention that the sentencing statute, the general sentencing statute, doesn't say you must sentence on the first date, sentencing is required, and any aggravators must be proved before that date. There's just simply nothing. The general sentencing statute sets forth a presumptive range, and this sentencing statute provides for an enhanced range if it applies. The rule allows for a delay if it's reasonable. We have no evidence here whatsoever that the prosecutor did anything intentionally to delay this. We don't know why it was delayed, because the defendant didn't object. My time is up. Thank you.
Mr. Jekyll, I gave your adversary 56 seconds extra. If you want any additional time, you're welcome to 56 seconds. That's right. No, that was, I gave you that before the rebuttal.
The statute that I say was circumvented here is the general sentencing statute. It says a sentence shall be in the presumptive range.
On that
situation. And that's what I wanted to add in rebuttal. So it is identical to Gallagher. The statute was circumvented by the delay.
Thank you. I want to thank both of you for your arguments and your briefs. And I apologize for my phone. It happened involuntarily. The case will be submitted on the briefs, and we will take a recess and resume tomorrow morning.